Welcome, everybody, to another episode of Always Bev, The Ripple Effect. I am your host, Barb Jordan. We've talked about active shooting. We've talked about the warning signs. But today, we have a very special guest.
I survived a mass shooting in the third safest city in America. There was a stoicness to him. That was the other thing. Everyone was drunk and jumping around and having fun and in a, you know, a pizza costume, right? And he was like the only guy who was so serious.
Between the years 2000 and 2018, in the United States, there were 277 mass shootings. Out of that 277, 884 innocent people were killed and 1,546 were wounded. I want to break down these stats between 2000 and 2018. Of where this is actually happening. I don't think I'm going to tell you something that you're not aware of, but 20% of the time it's happening in a place of education. And over 47% of the time it's happening in a business or an open public place. So oftentimes we hear the phrase, run, hide, fight. Do you know where exits are? When you enter a restaurant, when you enter a public building, do you know a point for a secondary exit? These things are so vital in today's world to stay safe. Our guest today is going to share how she survived a mass shooting and how it happened in an environment that she was so familiar with and how that atmosphere quickly changed from one of joy and happiness to pandemonium and horror. My guest today is Jessica Webb. Jessica, I want to thank you so much for joining me on this podcast and for sharing this experience and tragedy that you lived through.
Thanks, Barb. I'm so happy to be here today.
Yeah. Well, listen, you grew up in Southern California. You actually went to college in Channel Islands, but there was nowhere to hang out. Because my biggest question was, how did you find the Borderline Bar and Grill?
I know everyone asks me that. The first question they say is, why were you in a bar? So at the time, I was 18 and my college was surrounded by farmland. And there was really not much for an 18-year-old college kid and her friends to go do, except for to go to the country theme bar in the town over. So we'd go there every Wednesday and we pretty quickly became regulars there.
Okay, so take me back to November 7th, 2018. Do you remember that day before you got to the bar? Did you ever reflect on how did I get here?
Yeah. Oh, I think about that a lot. We had to back it up to the week before, which was Halloween. And we had, you know, typical college Halloween night. You're driving around trying to find a party and you can't find a party. And we ended up at the bar and, you know, full, everyone's in costumes and everyone's having a good time. And we're standing on the smoker's balcony, just kind of talking to some friends, hanging out. And I see this guy like in the corner, like dressed in all military fatigues. And I thought that was kind of weird because, you know, there are more fun costumes out there. And I hear a guy, a really drunk guy, walk up to the guy in the military fatigues. And he's like, why are you dressed like that? Like, dude, it's Halloween. And the guy in the military fatigue, I just really clearly remember him saying like, well, I was a Marine, so it doesn't matter. The next week, I, very typical Wednesday night, very normal day, went to school, went to my apartment. My friend, I didn't have a car at the time. I'd gotten into a car accident a few weeks before. And so my friend actually like had just broken up with her boyfriend or something. And she was like, I just want to get out and we're going to talk to boys. I'm going to go meet people. I was like, let's go do it. I was like, stir crazy. So we go to the bar and usually we got there at like maybe 9:30, but that time we got there at like 10:50, which was super late for us. And we like,
yeah, it was a school night, Jessica. Yeah. It was a school night.
I know. And so we get to the bar, we park right in front because, you know, it's like 10:50. There's parking in front of the bar. And we just walked in and I just remember it not being as busy as it usually was because Halloween was the week before. And then you know, the week after Halloween, because so many people went on Halloween, it kind of fizzled out. So I remember thinking it was pretty quiet, but it was nice because, you know, you have the place to yourself and you can kind of chill out. And then, yeah, it's just an incredibly normal night. Like didn't think twice about it at all.
Okay. So you walk in the front entrance, correct? Mm-hmm. Didn't notice anything out of the ordinary when you first entered the bar. You're familiar with the bar. You've been there before. You probably wanted to sit somewhere in the same vicinity that you normally sat. Is that correct?
Yeah. Yeah. So we walk in and immediately we do what we always do. We go to the bathroom. We talk to drunk girls in the bathroom. We, you know, give them advice on relationships, even though we didn't know anything about relationships. Then we take some pictures and we're walking around the bar and just kind of checking it out. And about 2 minutes before the incident happens, we're standing at the entrance of the dance floor, right between the front door and the entrance of the dance floor in the middle. And I said to my friend who went with me that day, I said, oh, do you want to catch the next dance? Because they're line dances, so they're kind of choreographed. So like, do you want to catch the next dance or do you want to go? Like, I think I saw a classmate. You want to go say hi to him? And she's like, oh, let's go say hi. Like we'll skip the dance. And I was like, okay. So we walk from the dance floor to the other side of the bar. And we're by the pool tables and kind of the back where it's a little bit quieter. But I can still like, we start talking to the classmate and his friend walks up. So it's like the four of us. The way I'm facing, I can see the front door and we're talking about like flannels and where you bought a flannel, like with the most normal mundane things. And I hear a pop and immediately I thought it's Halloween or at a country bar, somebody brought a fake gun and you know, like whatever. And then I hear another pop and it's still in my head. I'm like, oh, somebody's blowing up fireworks in the parking lot. Like it didn't. And then there was like the fourth pop where I like turned my head and I was looking towards the front door where I could hear it coming from. And I see a guy in all black with his gun pointed into the dance floor, just walking in, shooting into the dance floor. And then it was like 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. And I just like froze because it, you know, it takes like a full like second for your brain to be like, that is a man with a gun. That gun can kill you. Like it just, your brain is jumbled. So I froze. And as he's shooting into the dance floor, I just hear this like really loud voice just boom across the bar and just said, get down, everybody get down. So in the corner of my eye, there's a pool table. And I'm like, get under the pool table. And in the direction, there's two sides to me when I'm under the pool table. The side that I can hear the shots coming from, I keep looking in that direction because I know if he walks down these like three little stairs and he comes into my side of the bar, like I'm done. And there's in between the stairs and me, there's a man body shielding a woman. And they had just been playing pool and you can tell they just dropped to the ground like I did. On the other side of me, there is this group of girls in the corner in kind of an alcove. So I know that if I was in that alcove, the shooter couldn't see me. And at least it's like with people who, you know, whose brain might be working faster than mine at the moment. So I'm under the pool table for about a minute. And then at some point I could hear that the gunshots were getting farther away from me. So I get out of the pool table and I go with the girls in the corner. And there was something in me that was like, when I was in high school, I had a teacher during one of the many lockdowns we had in high school, who said, if you're ever in like a shooting situation, like scatter, because it's harder for them to like shoot. Or if you can't scatter, like go with a group so that it's like harder for them to get you. So you have like, you increase the chances of like a protection around you, which sounds really weird. But that kind of kicked in. And so I get with the group of girls and I just felt like these arms just pull me into the wall. And one girl actually turned my head so I couldn't see anything in the bar. And of course, me being me, like I immediately turned back to see, and the bar was just dead empty and it was dead silent. And somebody had pulled the music and it was just eerie. And the gunshots are still going and going and going and going. And there's this guy like next to the group of girls screaming for his girlfriend, trying to find her, and he's full panic attack. And it's weird because like in these hyper energetic moments, you have these moments of just like oh my God, get it together. Like, so one of the girls like rolls her eyes at him. It's just like, oh my gosh, she's right here. Like, calm down. And then we go back to being like freaking out. And then all of a sudden we can hear the gunshots got a little bit closer. And then they stopped and there was a break. And right in the break in the bullets, one of the girls like grabbed me and she just screamed, we got to get out of here. We ran out the smoker's door, down the smoker's balcony, where coincidentally I had seen the guy in the military fatigues the week before, down the hill, through the parking lot, found my friend hiding behind a truck in the parking lot, trying to call me. Somehow I got out of there with my phone, and she had had my ID and my credit card, which thank God we had that. Some people's phones got left behind and then, you know, people would call them and they couldn't. And I just, that to this day still freaks me out, knowing I, like, there would have been a possibility of me immediately not telling everyone that I got out okay. So I meet up with my friend in the parking lot. We run back to her car because, like I said, it's parked in the front. So it's right by the front door where the shooter is still in the building. And we get in the car, and as soon as our butts hit the seat, she just has a full panic attack, like screaming, crying. And I'm like, the shooter's going to walk out the door any second. Like, you need to get it together. I am like dead calm. And I said, okay, you need to put the key in the ignition. You need to turn the ignition. You need to put it in reverse. And so like, I'm walking her through like so slowly, and her mom is on the phone on speaker going, what's happening? What's going on? What's happening? I'm like, stop. Like, just pull the car out of the parking spot. So I get her to pull the car out of the parking spot and start to head out to the exit of the parking lot. And at the same moment we're pulling out of the parking lot, the first cop car is pulling in. And I see he pulls into the parking lot. A couple guys run up to the window of the car and they say, he's in there. Like, he's still going. He's in there trying to help out the cop. We kind of like hesitate for a second because we don't know if we're supposed to like stop. I don't know. There's like, with the cop car, we're supposed to stop. The cop car goes forward, and on the sidewalk, there's a man laying down on the sidewalk screaming bloody murder, like screaming worse than I've ever heard a man scream before. And there's people around him trying to help him out. And so we get out of the parking lot, we drive about 2-3 blocks. And I said, you need to get out. You need to let me drive. We need to switch cars, switch seats. So like we park, and she says like, okay. So we switch seats. And as soon as we open the doors to switch the seats, gunshots are still going. And all of a sudden, and we're right by the freeway, so we can hear all the first responders coming, the police and the firemen and the ambulance. So there's like a little bit of relief that like, okay, like the people whose job it is to like get people in an ambulance and take them to the hospital, like they're there, like it's okay. Like, that's not, I'm not trained for that. So like the right people are coming, or they're already there.
Help is on the way.
Help is on the way. Exactly. So we switch seats, and I'm now in the driver's seat halfway till school. That's when I like called my mom. Of course, it's middle of the night. She didn't respond, or she didn't answer. We get to school, and then all of a sudden it hits me like, wait, like I have the number of a regular, like a bar regular, like I need to call him. Like, I don't know if he was there or not. I call him, and he picks up the phone, and it was like the darkest like tone I'd ever heard in my life. And I was like, are you okay? And he goes, I wasn't there that night. But it was the way that he said I wasn't there, you could hear the survivor's guilt already in his voice. And I just said like, I love you, I'm glad you're alive, I'll talk to you later. And I hung up, and I called my dad right as we were turning into my school's campus. And I said, Dad, I'm okay. There's a shooter that walked into the bar. And my dad said, are you okay? And I said, yes, I'm okay. There's a shooter that walked into the bar, but Sarah and I got out safely. And he said, have you called your mom? And I said, I tried, she didn't wake up. And he said, you need to call your mom. Text me when you're safe and you're landed at school or whatever. And then I think he said, like, where are you right now? And I said, we're driving to school. So I hang up the phone.
What was some of the reaction from your friends and students on campus when you got back?
They come out and we hug them, and it just like trying to figure out what happened. And I'm standing on campus and I can just see lights turning on, like in the dorms. And like, it occurs to me like, oh, like I know what just happened, and people are probably getting the notifications on their phone and they're probably waking up to this. I ended up in one of my friends' dorms. She was kind of the only person who was awake at the time. And she's like pulling up the articles, and like the news articles are already going. And it's been like probably maybe an hour and a half since it had happened. And I'm like telling her what happened, because she's like, what, you know, are you okay? What happened? How'd you get out? And I'm telling her, she was the first person I told the story. And I'm telling her, and the more I'm talking, the more it's just a robot. Like I'm so disassociated from my surroundings that I'm just regurgitating information. So my dad starts texting me articles. You know, he says, like, do you know if the shooter's alive or dead? I was like, I don't know. So we start like, I'm like on my phone searching it. We end up driving back to my apartment. My roommate, her boyfriend, me drive back to my apartment, and 2 a.m. I'm, you know, up researching articles on the phone with my dad, trying to figure out everything. And then at like 2:30, we get the report that the shooter killed himself. And I went to sleep. I remember like putting on pajamas. Like I had to like walk myself through, like, this is a pajama shirt. You put like, so I put on pajamas, I get in bed, and I wake up the next morning, and there's a moment where like you don't know. Like it's like when you go through a breakup and you forget that you're heartbroken for a second. And you don't know. And I kind of wake up and I'm like staring at the ceiling, and I'm like, something happened last night. Like something bad. And my roommate walks up and she looks at me, and I was like, and as soon as I saw her, then I like remembered what happened. And I look at her and I'm like, oh my God, there was a shooter that walked into the bar. And she looks at me and she goes, 12 people died last night. And I was like, are you sure? Like, is it 12? Like, and I told her, I was, no, 12 people were injured. And I was like trying to convince her, like, no, that means that the bullets went into their arms and their butts and their non-vital organs, you know? And she was like, no, like 12 people died. And I was like, oh. And it wasn't until the day after that we actually got the list of victims' names. And then within the list of victims included the cashier girl who marked our hands, and we paid when we walked in, the promoter whose name we said to get a discount, the security guards outside, the guy who yelled, get down, the guy who actually went in to the building when there was a break in the bullets. I mean, it was just the people, the normal people that you saw were gone. And it was so eerie. And the one that I think hits me a little bit harder than the other ones, just because of who I am. There was an 18-year-old college student there named Elena Housley, and she literally went to the college next to me. She was the same age as me. She loved music. I loved singing. Like, it was just like, it was me or her. And when I saw her face for the first time, I was just broke down in tears, because like, I know that it was college night. There was, you know, if there was going to be a mass shooting, there were probably going to be a college student that was going to die. And it happened to be her instead of me or my friend or anyone I knew.
Sorry. I'm sorry that you went through this. Well, if you were going to talk to somebody about what if there was an active shooter, mm-hmm. if you're at a bar and there's ever an active shooter, tell me the first thing you would tell somebody.
First thing is hide. Get under bar tables, pull a table over to cover yourself. First thing is hide. If you can't hide, run. If you are hiding, you have about a couple more seconds to find an exit. So it helped a little bit. You also risk, you know, being in the bar longer. My friend actually who was standing next to me, she immediately remembered that there was a door behind her. So she immediately ran. I did not remember that there was a door behind me. So I, you know, needed the extra second to like get there.
I want to ask you about the week before when you were there for Halloween. You said you saw a man dressed up all in the army fatigue.
Yeah.
What was so significant that you remembered him from a week ago when you describe this active shooting scene?
So I like to start off my story with Halloween, because that was the shooter, was the guy in all the military fatigues. The shooter was previously a gunner in Afghanistan. He did, I think, I want to say two tours. He had been in the bar multiple times between Halloween and the shooting. He actually, rumor that he was in the bar right before the shooting, actually bought like shot, like somebody bought him a shot or something, and then went home, got dressed basically for the shooting, and then came back and committed the shooting.
You basically, your intuition a week ago was correct. You saw him.
It was, but not to the extent where I could have.
Yeah. Of course not. Of course not. But instinctively, you were like, you said the phrase, "That's weird."
Yeah,
it's exactly. Halloween. Why would you pick this outfit? That's what you said, right? Mm-hmm. Pretty similar. I always say, Jessica, when people use the word weird, that to me is, let's look at this situation. Now, of course, you know, I understand you didn't know who he was a week later, but your intuition, I want you to know, you have excellent intuition. You were able to identify somebody who gave you a bad feeling simply by the way they were dressed.
Mm-hmm. There was a stoicness to him. That was the other thing. Everyone was drunk and jumping around and having fun and in a, you know, a pizza costume, right? And he was like the only guy who was so serious and so intense. And it was, that was weird. And I totally agree. I think, you know, weird is your first instinct. Like, oh, this is not normal. This is out of it. This is strange.
How long did it take you to go out again, to go, I want to go to a bar? How long did that take you?
So this is where I think, the shooting that I survived is a bit different from other mass shootings, because a lot of other mass shootings, whether it's a school or, you know, a grocery store or a concert venue, they're like, if it's a school, you know the people. If it's a concert venue, a grocery store, you don't quite know the people. But the borderline community was so tight to begin with. And I remember telling my mom, like, borderline is the place we would have gone if the shooting had happened anywhere else. Like, if it hadn't happened anywhere else, borderline is where everyone would have come together to congregate, to heal each other. And that's kind of what happened is, within, I think, maybe a month and a half, the regulars and the employees of borderline, the DJ, everybody, they reopened in a temporary location. So almost immediately we were dancing again with everyone, doing our, and it was so healing because it was like, he didn't take this away from us. Like, the shooter took people and he took a huge chunk of it away from us, but the essence is still there and we can still be okay together and we can be here for each other and be together. And a lot of the times, a lot of the victims' families were coming and dancing with us. It has a huge range, but for me, I went the opposite. I didn't do the, like, I'm going to hide in the corner because I, you know, I'm scared. Like, I did the opposite. I was like, you motherfucker, if you think you're going to take this away from me, if you're going to take life away from me, like, I'm going to hit it 10 times harder. I'm going to go do everything. I'm going to go see everything. I'm going to go be in everything. So, but it's so tricky.
It's different for everybody. Everybody handles tragedy different. When you were in the bar that night, obviously you must look back and think to yourself, God, if we had chosen to dance, right? If you had chosen to dance, because you were about to dance, if you had made that choice, do you ever look at it like that one decision not to dance at that moment actually saved your life?
Absolutely. I think about it more in terms of, you know, I talked about Elena and the college student who died. I used to think about it as like, what if I, you know, I could have been the one, the college student that died. But now I kind of see it more of, if I had gone on the dance floor at that moment, the amount of trauma, the amount more trauma I would have had being on the dance floor and seeing what I would have seen on the dance floor, that would have taken so much more to heal from and so much more to overcome and so many more like effects from PTSD I would have gotten from that. So I don't necessarily think, I don't know if I would have, you know, died or not, but just, I think I actually, in my opinion, saw very little of the shooting. And I'm grateful for how much I saw. And I'm grateful that I didn't see anybody collapse. I didn't see bodies. I didn't see blood. I saw a little bit of blood, but not enough to really, you know, and I think out of all the places in the bar, I was in one of the better places to be. So I think about that a lot in terms of how much worse. Yeah, the dance floor was not the place to be. And a lot of people on the dance floor actually were trying to get off the dance floor so fast that people started dogpiling and people, you know, hurt ankles and legs and things like that. And just trying to scatter.
When you go to a restaurant, a bar now, when you first walk in, do you make a plan now? Do you know, do you identify the exits now when you go into places?
I definitely identify the exits. I definitely see the exits. And it's actually the smaller the bar actually makes me more nervous. The more people there are, it feels like the more almost like protection is around me. The smaller, the more it's like you're such a close target. That kind of freaks me out a little bit. But usually I'm okay. I'm okay. And then every once in a while there would be some unexplainable thing that I just have to leave and I can't explain it. It's too much and I just leave. But it's very rare that happens.
If somebody said to you, if you were somewhere and somebody said, yeah, I heard a pop, pop, would you ever think again, if you ever heard pop, pop, would you ever think it's firecrackers or would you immediately go to active shooting now?
Oh, immediately go to active shooting. Immediately. I think also, you know, even when it's not the 4th of July, or when it is the 4th of July, when it's not the 4th of July, and, you know, people have firecrackers, I immediately go to gunshot. I can't undo that one now.
Yeah. Well, how does it affect you when you hear the story of another active shooter?
I relive it all over again. I can like picture the mother, you know, finding out her son has died. You can feel like in your body, you can just feel every emotion that you've already felt because you've been there. You know that there's nothing you can do about it. And you know that it took me a solid year. And unfortunately, it happens all the time. And so it's not like, okay, you know, once every 10 years we have this happen. It's like once a week we have this happen. And it's
you're getting triggered just weekly here, especially in the United States. And yeah. it's gotta be daunting to go through that on a regular basis.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. In the United States, violence is not that weird. We're very normal we're very accustomed to violence. Violence is not something that we see. We think, wow, that's not, you know, that's not us. That's not what makes us Americans. So because violence is not weird to us, it's almost normal to us. We're used to seeing this on the news all the time. We're used to seeing it happen all the time. It's hard to disassociate like what is normal. You know, mass shootings are not normal. That's really weird. A lot of countries, most countries, don't have mass shootings. And when they see us have mass shootings, that is so freaking weird. Like, why do these keep happening?
So why do people want to visit America? Let's go on a family vacation. And why do we want to go to America?
Yeah. And it's schools. I think, you know, nobody wants to see kids die, but the fact that we're so used to seeing school shootings, like that is so weird. That's not okay. That's so odd.
What are you doing now to make America more safe?
So currently I'm with the organization called Every Town for Gun Sense in America, also known as Moms Demand Action, Students Demand Action. So I am a survivor fellow. I speak at Moms Demand Action meetings and basically tell my story.
Awesome. Is there anything that you want to share that I haven't asked you about today?
Yeah. So I survived a mass shooting in the third safest city in America. Incredibly safe neighborhood. The bar that I survived a mass shooting in, filled with off-duty firemen, off-duty cops, you know, active and non-active duty military, like huge guys, protective men who did a lot of good getting people out and really rescued people. There was no safer place for me to be right before the shooter walked in the entire world. That was like prime, you know, safety. And then the shooter walked in and it was the most unsafe place in the world, of course. A year and a month before the borderline shooting happened, we had the Las Vegas shooting happen, which was on October 1st, 2017. The Las Vegas shooting, 60 people died in the Las Vegas shooting. 867 people were injured. 411 of those were injured by gunfire. In mass shootings, you typically have, you know, double the number of people who are killed, you know, are injured, most of those by gunfire. In our shooting, the shooting I survived, we had 12 people die and one person was injured by gunfire because the shooter was a trained professional. He was a trained shooter. And he did all that damage with a handgun, which usually, you know, shootings are done with AR-15s and AK-47s. And this guy did a lot of damage with just a handgun. One of the victims, his name is Telemus Orphanos. He is the one who ran in from the parking lot into the bar to fight the shooter. That was the break in the bullets that I got out of the building, and a lot of people's stories, that break in the bullets was part of their story of getting out of the building. Tell was in the Navy, and then he survived the Route 91 Las Vegas shooting. And then he wasn't even in the building in Borderline. He was in the parking lot and he ran in to fight the shooter and he had a knife with him. And we always say that Tell like sacrificed himself for us because he did.
He did. Why do you think, or did you ever learn why this shooter targeted Borderline?
Yes. I have a very love-hate relationship with the motive concept, because on one hand, I totally get it. I think the human brain wants to find a reason and wants to find logic. And the simple answer is there is absolutely no logic. There's absolutely no reason why this guy is absolutely crazy and just went off the deep end. We know that he had severe PTSD that was untreated. He had multiple 5150s, which is suicide watch, come to his house. History of violence against women. He assaulted a track coach when he was in high school. He was not held accountable because, you know, he just got into the Marines and they didn't want to ruin a young boy's future. So he got off scot-free, and the track coach later came out exactly 10 years after the assault happened, which is when the shooting happened, and said, you know, wow, he didn't listen to me now, and we have a shooter on our hands. This guy he lived at home with his mom, and there were, you know, the neighbors had reports of seeing like holes in the wall. So this is where the kind of official quote unquote motive, kind of the kind of like textbook answer. He actually posted on social media during the shooting and said, it was like a tweet, I think, or maybe Instagram. And he said, you know, I can't, you know, I wish I was going to like be alive to see all the reasons that people come up with, the reason I like did this. But to be honest, like life is boring, so why not? And I think the insanity just like pours out of that. I mean, it's crazy to say the least. Like, and I remember telling my friends, like, I feel like if the shooter had seen the pain and the toll, the emotional toll this is taking, and this was like his community. He went to high school with a lot of people in the bar. He grew up in Thousand Oaks his whole life. This was not some like random person who came in. This was someone who was born and raised in the community, who had been to the bar multiple times. And I would say to my friends, like, you think if he had known like the emotional toll that this had taken on the community, he wouldn't have done it. And somebody just looked at me and was like, oh, he knew. Like, he knew exactly what he was doing. He knew how much pain it would be. He knew what was going to happen. He knew how much, you know, how costly in both lives and money this was going to be. And I remember thinking like, oh yeah, like he did. Like you don't commit a mass shooting unless you know how much pain is going to happen.
Right. People that commit violence and that violence continues to progress, it won't stop until that person gets the help that they need.
Exactly.
And that is where, in my opinion, this active shooter, he was just kept going and going. It started that, as you know, mentioned, it probably started 10 years prior and got worse and worse and worse. Yeah. And this is the end of it.
Yeah. And this shooter very heavily benefited from, he's a young guy. It's, you know, don't ruin his future. He made a mistake. That is the flaw, right? That's the flaw that kept him going. When he was 18 and he sexually assaulted a track coach, that should have been taken seriously. That was in 2008. You know, that's before Me Too. That's before anything. So here's this 18-year-old boy growing up in a world where he is allowed to run around and do whatever he wants. There's no repercussions. And if he makes a mistake, oh, it's, you know, he didn't know, it's okay. There's all these excuses. And then what happens is you take this kid who should have been dealt with. And by dealt with, I mean, you know, put into therapy, gotten resources, told, like, punished for his action, the assault, sexually assaulting a track coach. But because he didn't, because he just got sent the message, he did a very serious thing and was sent the message of like, no, it's okay, you're fine. You made a mistake. They gave him a pass. What happens? He goes to Afghanistan and they train him to be a killer, and he's a gunner in Afghanistan. So he comes back and he's already got trauma, right? He on top of this, he's got PTSD. Now you're adding loneliness and isolation and, you know, adjustments back into society, like from military life back into civilian life. You're adding all of these elements that create an incredibly damaged person with no resources. One part that breaks my heart about this whole incident is one of the victims, his name is Dan Manrique. He was, you know, in the military. He came back and his whole life was dedicated to, it's called Red, White, and Blue. It's an organization foundation that helps military personnel readjust back into civilian life. So they would go on camping trips, biking, you know, like they'd go bike around. And it was about community. It was about the sense of community. And immediately after the borderline shooting happened, and, you know, Dan Manrique's family came out and said, like, the shooter is the type of person that Dan would have wanted to help and support and heal. And that is like heartbreaking to me, because the person who could have been that source of support and stability and love to the shooter killed. Like, so much of our culture is enabling people like that who have mental illnesses. It's why we have background checks now. It's why we have red flag laws. Things that, you know, it's a sane person with a gun who's responsible, who keeps it in a locked case when it's not, you know, when they don't need it. We love those people. Those are the people we like. We like people who are safe about guns. It's the people who we know have criminal histories, who have committed multiple acts of violence against women, who, you know, are incredibly mentally unstable. Those are the people that we need to keep the guns out of their hands. And that's, you know, that's the difference between America and other countries who don't have this problem. It's enabling, right?
No, it's good insight. And I think that, you know, that we can go on and on about how do you help these people, but what we have to recognize are warning signs with people like this, you know, and when you see warning signs for people like this in your life or a neighbor or whatever it is, we have to take precautions, you know, and we have to warn people. I can't blame whoever was in this gunman's life, but somebody needed to try to get him help.
Many people, you know, it's, I don't think it's one person. It's many people. Principal of his school that refused to, you know, kick him out of school and let, you know, not stop his graduation. That's a principal. It's a male principal who is took the side of an 18-year-old boy student over his own employee. But in terms of warning signs, with gun violence, especially mass acts of gun violence, like mass shootings, or really high numbers in gun violence, violence against women is the biggest indicator. Most gun perpetrators have a history of violence against women, which kind of comes back to the warning signs of, like, if you have a neighbor, you know, and you can tell it's a domestic violence case, and at any point in time, you know, you hear like he threatens her with a gun or there's a gun in the house, you can call the cops and say exactly what's going on, and you don't know how many women's life you can save. I work with high schoolers, and the biggest, they deal with, you know, gun threats. And the biggest thing I tell them is see something, say something, you know, and I tell them, if you see something, say something, and you tell a teacher and the teacher shrugs you off and they say, like, don't worry about it, go to the principal. The principal shows you off, call the cops, make a big deal about it. It is not okay that, you know, things happen. It's not okay that this is normal. And so many of my high schoolers I work with, they were like, oh, but it happens all the time. And I was like, that's the problem. The problem is that think it happens all the time, and that's your heat that you go on with your day. It's apathy. That what kills, what the main cause of social problems, the reason we keep having social problems, is apathy.
Some people, like you said, it's they're conditioned. We hear these stories all the time, whether it's active shooting, whether it's violence against women, but people need to take action. People need mm-hmm. to stand up. People need to do something to stay safe. It takes mm-hmm. work to stay safe. And if you're not going to take action, well, then it's just a matter of time in your
exactly.
environment.
Exactly. Sometimes things can be so insanely obvious to us, and we still don't understand that we don't have to have that in our society. And I think Me Too movement is an example of that. Black Lives Matter is an example of that, because, you know, sexual assault, bad, like, right? Like, there's no question about it. But we were so used to these, you know, men in power who were just getting away with it left and right, that we just kind of thought, you know, like, that's the name of the game. Like, what can you do? Not until somebody made it a huge deal. Now the culture is totally different. You know, I think there's this myth that, like, we can't choose the society we live in, and we absolutely can. That, you know, society is meant to change. It's meant to evolve. It's meant to keep going forward and to be a safer, better place. And the overall trend from, you know, the past 100 years is that the world is getting better. It is getting safer. But it's not going to be the safest place when we have kids dying in school shootings.
What's one of the best examples that you can give to show people that taking charge of their communities can make a difference?
Parent families of the Sandy Hook shooting just won a $73 million settlement against the gun manufacturer in Remington. And that's the first time in our entire country's history that that's happened with gun manufacturers. But that's still 10 years after the shooting happened, you know? Getting out of this culture of, you know, we're used to that, like, American ideal of, like, the cowboy gunslinging notion. And that is just not where we are as a country anymore. That is not what's okay and what's going to be accepted.
Yeah. You have a lot of great points. I'm so glad that you are on this episode, because I think you've given just so many different avenues for us to think and different ways for all of us to take action. So I want to thank you for that.
Thank you.
Yeah. Okay. Now listen, you're now part of Always Bev, the Ripple Effect. So you and I are always going to be connected. If you mm-hmm. ever need anything, I want you to know that you can reach out. Okay.
Thank you so much.
All right. Thanks, Jess.
Thank you.
So how do we identify warning signs for our everyday life? Well, let's say you're at church. Somebody walks in with a backpack. To me, that doesn't fit the environment. I've been at a political rally before inside a building where somebody just wasn't paying attention to the speaker, had a backpack on, and was just pacing back and forth around the room. I absolutely reported that to the law enforcement that were in the building, and they already had their eye on this individual. Warning signs for people in our lives. Well, somebody that starts to be more erratic or aggressive, they become hostile. They make claims of injustice. They make statements of retribution. All those things you can't ignore, especially in today's world. And when we are out and about, we should always have a plan. Let's say you're going to a concert, a farmer's market, the movies, whatever it is. Know the exits. Know more than one way in and one way out. And if you are going to a big public place, have a destination to meet if for some reason your group gets separated. Have a meeting place outside of the building or away from the location where everybody can. So oftentimes we hear, what should you do when there's an active shooter? Run, hide, and fight. And don't just run. Identify where the shots are coming and run to the exit in the opposite direction of the gunfire. Leave all of your personal belongings behind. Get out the door if possible. Hide. Get out of view. If you can lock yourself in an office, if you can lock a door, barricade the door, put things up against the door, hide from a shooter. And if you are hiding, turn off the ringer of your cell phone. Turn off anything that could make noise that may draw attention to the shooter that somebody is in a certain location. You should always call 911, and even if you can't speak for fear that a shooter might hear you, leave the phone on so the dispatcher can listen to your surroundings. And if you can't run and you can't hide, your last resort is to fight. Throw something at the shooter. Find a weapon, whatever it might be. It could be a stapler. It could be a book. It could be a wine bottle. Attack the shooter. Attack the shooter. And if you have a chance to grab that gun, I was always taught, grab the gun and thrust it upwards, because we want the gunshots to go into the sky, not at somebody else at the location. Heavy stuff, but that's today's world. On my next episode, we are going to have a victim who herself was in sex trafficking, how she got in and how she got out. Following that episode, we have the best friend of Susan Powell, a woman that went missing when her husband took her two sons on a camping trip in the middle of a blizzard. Her body has never been found. I wonder who did that one. I'm your host, Barb Jordan. Thanks for joining me on another episode of Always Bev, The Ripple Effect.